Welcome to Hebraic Insights in the Gospels. Join us every Sabbath on Zion Road Radio for a look at the life, deeds, and words of Yeshua Messiah and his followers from the Torah-centric Hebraic perspective they were originally lived and written in. Today's program is on Luke chapter 19, verse 28 through verse 48. Please get out your Bible and follow along. When Messiah presented himself as the King of Israel, why did he go into Jerusalem riding on a donkey? What was the significance of entering Jerusalem from Bethany? Why did so many of the poor accept him as their king, while the corrupt elite rejected him? Why do so many of the world's leaders throughout history reject God? What makes Messiah and his kingdom so much better than the leadership of the ungodly elite? Apart from God, can there ever be a system of leadership that overcomes man's lust for power? Why should we, as good citizens of Messiah's kingdom, avoid taking justice into our own hands? Is Messiah a pacifist who will allow the wicked to oppress the righteous forever? Or will there be a day of judgment? How will Messiah deal with the corrupt elitists of our day when he returns? What hope do the poor and the oppressed have that the wicked do not? Stay tuned throughout today's program for Eliyahu ben David's insight on these questions and more in Luke chapter 19, verse 28 through verse 48. And now, here's Eliyahu ben David.
Shabbat Shalom, friends. Our theme is Behold Your King. And we're looking at Luke chapter 19 and the triumphal entry and surrounding events. And I think we're going to find this very encouraging and exciting. Yeshua presented himself to his people as the King of Israel. And the Messiah came. This was the first coming of Messiah to his people. And it's very curious that Messiah came riding on a donkey. And if it weren't for the prophecy in the book of Zechariah, nobody would ever expect a king to present himself riding on a donkey. You know, one thing, when you just spend a few minutes looking at donkeys and you see people riding donkeys, the first thing that comes to mind is how ridiculous it looks, right? You have these great big people riding these little animals that aren't a lot bigger than a large dog. And it seems so strange when you see that. And I think when you think of the Messiah of Israel coming, presenting himself as the king, riding a donkey, you know, we want to think of it as like this grand, amazing thing, but on a certain level, it looks kind of ridiculous. You know, and I think that's part of the story. That's part of what we kind of have to think about. Let's look at the verses here a little bit more. It said, having said these things, he went on ahead going up to Jerusalem. So they're still on their way to Jerusalem. And then it says, it happened when he drew near to Bethphage and Bethany at the mountain that is called Olivet, he sent two of his disciples, saying, go your way into the village on the other side, in which as you enter, you will find a colt tied whereon no man ever yet sat. Untie it and bring it. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it? Say to him, Adonai needs it. So we have these two cities, Bethphage and Bethany. And these were very close together. That's why it mentions the two of them. Probably if you were walking from one to the other, you might not really notice where one would become the other. It's kind of like Minneapolis and St. Paul, only smaller. You know, something like that, cities together. And you get to Bethany first on the way. So it says as they drew close, then that's when Yeshua sent these two disciples. And I was looking at this, into the village on the other side. Well, it could be talking about on the other side of the village. So like as they're coming into the village of Bethany, on the other side of the village of Bethany is where they would find the donkey. Or it might be in the other city. Could be one of the two. But what's interesting to me here is that Yeshua launched his triumphal entry into Jerusalem as king on a donkey from the town of Bethany. And the word Beth, of course, we know means house in Hebrew, and Ani means the afflicted or the poor. So this is the house of the poor or the poorhouse. I think a lot of us have heard of the poorhouse, right? Nobody wants to go to the poorhouse. Bethany is the poorhouse. So I think this is kind of explanatory of why Yeshua was riding on a donkey. Because poor people don't ride on horses, do they? Have a little more information. Bethany was the site of an almshouse for the poor and a place of care for the sick. Now, you always find these kinds of places in most of the world in the poor areas. Rich people don't want to have a place for poor people in their neighborhood. So you always find these kinds of places in poorer areas. There's a hint of association between Bethany and care of the sick in the Gospels. Mark tells of Simon the leper's house being there. I doubt that any Pharisees wanted a leper living next door. Yeshua received urgent word of Lazarus' illness from Bethany. It seems like Bethany was kind of a center for Yeshua's ministry when he was near Jerusalem. And there's good reasons for that. This is a 2,000-year-old tomb, thought to be the actual tomb of Lazarus. Found along with this is thought to be the house of Mary and Martha. And this Bethany tomb of Lazarus has been identified as a tomb of the gospel account since at least the 4th century. And there are ancient church fathers from the early centuries that verify this location as being the tomb of Lazarus in Bethany. So I think that's just kind of interesting. Not only that, but a lot of work has been done in Bethany, unearthing graves there and doing research as to who the people were that lived in Bethany. And ossuaries, which are bone boxes, have been dug up, thousands of them in Bethany. And these reveal that in the time of Yeshua, Bethany was largely settled by people from Galilee who wanted to move there and live near Jerusalem. And so these folks likely had relatives in Galilee, right? These were basically the same people that Yeshua had been ministering to when he was in Galilee. So this is a different class of people than the people in Jerusalem. You know, all of the people of Jerusalem had to go up to Jerusalem for the feasts, but otherwise, not all of them were really welcome there, because Jerusalem was dominated by the rich, the wealthy, and the powerful. That was the case. Well, when you look at Bethany, you see the Mount of Olives rising in between Bethany and Jerusalem. Bethany was out of the view of the temple and of Jerusalem. So that made its location suitable as a home for the poor, the care of the sick, all the stuff the wealthy people didn't want to see. It's hidden over behind the mountain. It's, today we might say, the other side of the tracks. That's Bethany. And I think it helps us to understand that when Yeshua launched his triumphant entry from this place, it's consistent with everything we've seen about him as we've been going through the Gospels. Yeshua was not ashamed of the poor people and the common people. In fact, those were the people clearly that he identified with. Even though he was comfortable eating meals in the homes of the wealthy, he always gave them an earful, however, whenever he did. But he really identified more closely with the common people and the poor. And this is really quite an amazing contrast, what he did with the whole leadership of that area, the elite of that area. We have some more here. Gazana says, those who were sent went away and found things just as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners said to them, "Why are you untying the colt?" They said, "Adonai needs it." And what struck me about it is Messiah saying, "Adonai needs it." Because I really don't think about him as needing anything. I think he pretty much has everything. But the truth is, obviously, he does have need of things. I think that's kind of in a relative sense, but what it means is that we get to provide things that he needs in the sense of being part of the divine plan. And I just thought that was kind of a cool thing too. And so I'm not going into all these details. Of course, they did find the colt and so on, and they brought it to Yeshua. And they began on their way. Now, if you think of this, if you think of this happening while they're in Bethany, probably since they were bringing it to Yeshua, he's still sort of on the outskirts of Bethany, on the farthest side away from Jerusalem. So he's having to go through Bethany. And his disciples that are with him and those who had been following him on his trip, they were putting their cloaks in the road. They were crying out. And so as they were doing this, he's going right through these towns where his people are, right? Where the poor people, where the common people were. And so this really explains how there are a multitude of disciples there as he is moving along the path about a mile and a half or so to Jerusalem. Because as these people are seeing this happen, these are the people he's been ministering to. And so they come out and they join in receiving Yeshua as their king. And you know, a lot of them were thinking, I was wondering when this was going to happen, right? Because these are the people that he had been ministering to. They saw the amazing things that he did, and they wanted him to be their king. They wanted him to be their king, and they were praising God to have a king that actually cared about them. That's why I'm glad to have him as my king. As he was now getting near at the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise Elohim with a loud voice for all the mighty works which they had seen. So again, these were his people that he had been ministering to. Now, he would minister to anybody. He would minister to the wealthy. But those people don't normally show up, right? Because, let's face it, you know, they don't like to rub elbows with the lower classes, right? They might get cooties or something, like we used to say when I was in high school. And that's just the attitude, you know, and that's been the attitude through history. And I'm not just criticizing these people. Pretty much globally, that's how it is. The upper classes look down on the lower classes of people. And that's how it was in Jerusalem and Judea. So when Messiah did all of these great things, usually the vast majority of the people were the common people and the poor people, and they had seen him do these things. So they were the ones that showed up. They were the ones that said, blessed is the king who comes in the name of Adonai. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. You know, they might have said this because it's in the scriptures and it's part of the prophecy. But maybe Luke specifically left out the prophecy because he wanted to focus on the fact that this is what these people really thought. In other words, they were fulfilling the prophecy simply by saying what they thought. And the prophecy knew in advance, Yahweh knew, that this is how the people would respond to the Messiah. I don't think any of this was really set up to match the prophecy. That's what I'm saying. I don't think it needed to be, because when you realize where Messiah was when he launched his triumphal entry, no horses. If there's any animals at all, they're donkeys, right? You've got the poor who have been greatly blessed. And you know what? If this is the place of the sick, can you imagine the work that Yeshua Messiah did in Bethany? Because we had read earlier, he cured everybody that came to him with an illness. It must have been absolutely phenomenal what he did in those cities. And of course, even raised the dead Lazarus, as the book of John tells us. So Yeshua was sent to the poor, and it was largely the poor who accepted him and became his disciples. And they were the ones who recognized him as their king. Here's more about that. Yeshua said, quoting from the prophet Isaiah, he has anointed me to preach the gospel, or the good news, to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed. This is talking about all the poor and sick people, right? That's who he was anointed to minister to, all the poor and sick people. The very people that really the wealthy elite didn't really care about. I think it's something to think about that. Because, you know, a lot of times we think about Messiah as just kind of coming for everybody. And in a way, he did, because they all could respond. Every person could respond. But the way it actually worked out is that it was the poor, the sick, the possessed, and the oppressed that were the ones who responded, the ones with the greatest need. And he had a special heart for those people. These were the ones that became his disciples. This is part of why, even after Yeshua was killed and was resurrected and ascended to heaven, that there was such animosity towards his disciples, because the elite people looked down on the disciples, who a great number of them in the early days were Galileans, and they saw them as rabble, actually. So let's look a little more here. Here's another verse from Luke chapter 6. You probably remember we read this. He lifted up his eyes toward his disciples and said, "Blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God." And it's interesting, he's looking at the disciples and he's saying, "Blessed are you poor." What does that mean? He's calling the two one thing. He's saying that the disciples are also the poor. So that must be largely how it was. The poor, now not necessarily meaning the destitute. You know, there's a huge gap between the people who were just the common people and the wealthy people. And this exists in the world just about everywhere you go. Many places in the world, you'll have a part of town where people are just obscenely wealthy, and you drive a little ways away and you find an entirely different situation. And that's basically how things were. But Yeshua said, "Of the poor, yours is the kingdom of God." And there's a reason for this. It's because the poor have problems that they can't solve with money, because they don't have enough money, and that they can't solve with influence, because they don't have any influence. And so what are they left with? They're left with crying out to God. And so it opens up their heart to God. You know, sometimes people complain because they don't have great wealth. But if you don't have great wealth, thank God for it. Thank God that he didn't burden you with great wealth that would shut your heart to the knowledge of the truth. Yes, there are some exceptions, but not a lot. Not a lot. Zechariah 9:9 is the prophecy that Matthew points out that Luke didn't even mention. "Rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king comes to you. He is righteous and having salvation," Yeshua, "lowly and riding on a donkey," even on a colt, "the foal of a donkey." So when he did come into Jerusalem and he's riding on a donkey, the people are calling him their king. Do you suppose those religious leaders knew what this was about? Of course they did, right? What a statement. What he was doing was an amazing statement before the eyes of all of Jerusalem, and especially before the eyes of the ruling class. This is why he told them in Galilee, "Don't tell anybody I'm the Messiah." Because there was going to be a time for him to present himself officially, you might say, as who he was. And this was the time. They had a choice. They could accept their king. They saw the prophecy being fulfilled. Surely, even if they didn't see it, they all heard about the miracles that he had done, heard about his teaching. Some of them had actually heard his very teaching. They had a choice, and they could have chosen the Son of God to be their king. Behold, your king comes to you lowly and riding on a donkey. This word lowly from the book of Zechariah is the same word that's part of the word Bethany, ani. It means poor, afflicted, humble. Interestingly, Messiah did not only identify with the poor and the humble, he himself came to them as poor and humble. Never have we had a king like this. The world doesn't choose kings like this. Only this kind of king can understand the needs of the poor and humble. When you look at a donkey next to a horse, it just tells you everything, doesn't it? In Bible times, horses were for the aristocrats and the warriors. The poor people, they got the donkeys. They needed cheap, reliable transportation, a work animal they could afford. So that was the donkey. So they looked ridiculous riding on the donkey, but you know what? That's the best they could do. It's as if Yeshua showed up for his coronation driving a Volkswagen Beetle. What would they say? What would they say? It's kind of shocking in a way. It's really a shocking picture. Kind of ridiculous in the minds of the elite. Some of the Pharisees from the multitude said to him, "Rabbi, rebuke your disciples." Why did they say that? This whole picture to them was preposterous. A king riding a donkey. To them, this is like a show, right? Like some kind of a ridiculous comedy. There's no way that they could really even grasp this. And yet, Yeshua was not someone to be trifled with. Though he was lowly, he had power. He had power they didn't even have, right? But aside from the miracles he could do, the biggest power that he wielded with them was the power of the truth. He was not afraid to tell them the truth. Anybody that would do this, obviously, is not afraid of anything. Isn't that true? He was not afraid of anything. This is one of the reasons why I am so proud to have him as my king. Because he is so absolutely fearless. You know, as a man, not just as the Son of God, but this was absolutely fearless to do what he did. But it only gets more fearless as we go, right? So he told them, "I tell you that if these were silent, the stones would cry out." It was that important an event. This was a divine event. And he was letting them know it. So let's talk about these people. Here's some of the reasons why they would not accept him and were really so offended. Because a lowly king is the natural enemy of the elite. Right? Because if you have a lowly king who has authority, how is he going to feel about the proud and haughty elite? They would have no power over him. They would have no way to bribe him. They would have no way to control him. He's not one of them. So he doesn't favor them. They depend on that. What is going on, for example, in Washington, D.C. right now? As an example, the wealthy elite, the corporations, they all send their lobbyists to the rulers. And the rulers, they're all wanting that money. They're all wanting that support from the wealthy. And that's really what feeds the whole machine, isn't it? And what happens to the common man and the lowly? Well, they claim to care. But how come the things that the majority of the people want to see happen never happen? Because they're not the ones that have the power. And the elite want to keep it that way. And that's always been true. If they were to accept him as their king, that would mark the end of their authority and control. Didn't want to let that happen. They will do anything to hang on to power. This is the lesson of history. The powerful will do anything to hang on to power and to amass more if they can. That's just the lesson of history. So because of that, the elite class will never, underline never, submit to divine authority. That's why there must be a war between them and the rightful king. It can't happen peacefully. He came peacefully. You notice that? On his first coming, he gave them the benefit of the doubt. That's what happened. He didn't come to them ready to make war with them. He came to them riding on a donkey, lowly. He gave them a chance, right? That's what he did. All the while knowing their hearts. But they could never say, well, he tried to force us. Because he didn't do that. So when he was drawing near the city and he wept, it was because of those people. You know, he wasn't real worried about the people in Bethany and Bethphage and Galilee that had seen his wonders, that even named him as the king, though they had no power to put him into office. That's where he was drawing his disciples from. But as he approached Jerusalem, which is supposed to be the holy city, knowing that it is fully in the grip of these wicked people, he could do nothing but weep for that city. Because he knew what their lust for their authority and power would bring on that city. It was a class struggle. It was. But Yeshua was not trying to raise up people to fight against that upper class. He wasn't trying to do that. He was just trying to bless the poor people, the common people. He didn't incite them to violence against their evil leaders. However, he and they were so threatening simply in speaking the truth and standing up for the truth that the leaders became their vicious enemies anyway. Don't be surprised when the same thing happens to you. This world, driven by the evil plans of the elite, is moving farther and farther and farther away from righteousness, farther and farther and farther away from the Torah, farther and farther away from the Creator. And this makes those who align themselves with Him their natural enemies. So though you mean them no harm, you don't want to hurt them in any way, you're not attacking them, they will attack you. This is happening many places in the world right now. And don't think it can't happen in America, because you know what? We've said that about a lot of things that now have happened in America. It can happen here. It can and will happen everywhere, because there is an oppressive world government just over the horizon. And that's a fact. Because just as with them, we are indeed in a time of visitation. This is why we see this big separation going on in the world. It's because even now, Messiah is visiting them from heaven, and he is giving them enough rope for them to fully express what they want to do and to allow the righteous-hearted people of the world to see it. It's all right there on your TV screen, right on your computer screen. You get to see it all unfolding before you. You get to see who these people really are and what they're really doing. And you can align yourself with them because you think they're going to be the winners and you want to be like them and you want all the wealth and power they have. Or if you have a righteous heart, you'll be disgusted by them and everything they're doing, and you'll want to set yourself apart to be part of Yahweh's holy people. Those are the two choices that everybody will be left with as these last days progress forward. Messiah was such a pacifist. Not really. When he came into Jerusalem, realize he's coming in as the king. So his first act as king coming into Jerusalem is to assert his power as king to clean up the corruption at the temple. So he went into the temple and really demonstrated to everybody that his kingdom was not going to tolerate the abuses of the elite at the expense of the righteous, the noble, the just, and the holiness of Elohim. He whipped them. He went right in and he whipped them, and he drove them right out of the temple. Now, that's not a very Christian thing to do, but he did it. Does that mean we should do it? I'm not the king. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not the king. He was the king. Jerusalem, the city of David. He's the son of David. Who else is going to straighten out that mess? So, it fell to him to do it. He did it. And in doing it, he followed the example of righteous kings in the line of David, like Josiah, like Hezekiah, and others who stood against apostasy and idolatry and evil. And this is exactly what we should expect him to do when he goes into Jerusalem. The first order of business is to come to grips with the evil that had taken over the house of God. That's what he did. Do you think he knew where that was going to take him? He totally forced those religious leaders to have to decide who they were and what they were going to do. He knew what they would do. Of course, the elite sought to destroy him. They'll go to any lengths to hang on to their wealth and power. That was true then. It is still true today. It has been true throughout history. And we know the reason. You know, people would like to tell you that people are basically good. The Bible tells you we're not. We're born in sin. This is the fallen nature of man. And very few are able to come into a position of power and not abuse it. This is what happens. And you see, let's say you are a righteous person and somehow you get into a position of power, like, say, Daniel. If everybody else that's in power is wicked, you see how that really limits what you can do? So, yeah, there are a few that don't go that way. And every one of them, by the way, that don't go that way, fear the living God. That's the reason they don't go that way. If you don't have that in your heart, you know, what is it? Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's what always happens. In the history of Israel, none of the kings of the northern kingdom, the 10-tribe kingdom, not one of them was righteous. Not one. Not one was righteous. In Jerusalem, in the Davidic line, of all the kings that ruled, there were five that were righteous or semi-righteous. You know what I'm saying? And they're probably the best the world has ever seen, other than Messiah, in terms of rulers. So it's a big problem. It is the problem, really. It is the problem with the world, this matter of government. Well, let's take a look at how this is today. I've heard different statistics about this. This is probably the most scary one. 8 billionaires have as much wealth as half of the world population, the poorest half. Think about that. 8 people are hoarding as much wealth as half of the population of the world. That's according to Oxfam. You know, this is worse than it's ever been in history. Sometimes we think back and we think of like ancient Egypt and we think, okay, there was a wealthy pharaoh and there were all these slaves. Actually, the truth is, the gap between the super wealthy and the ordinary person, the wealth gap, is the greatest it has ever been in history. And not only that, but the economic system of the world has been so rigged by these people that it just keeps getting more that way. And the advantage we have in the modern era is we have all the statistics, we have all of the data, we have the computers to know it. And we do know it. Well, is this just a matter of numbers, or does this mean something? Well, it means this. Poverty. Millions of people living in abject poverty. And many millions of others who are living hand to mouth every day, every week. While 8 people are hoarding half of the world's wealth. Does that sound right to you? And then you know what they're telling us, what they've been telling us for a long time through the media. The problem is overpopulation. Yeah, I'm thinking maybe we have 8 people too much. You know, Yahweh made this earth to produce enough for every person. We can all have an abundance. If it weren't for the fact that we have this system that is put in place so that these super elite people are able to siphon off all of this wealth for themselves. So much more wealth, really, than any one person could ever possibly use. That's more than just economics. That has to do with evil. How can you in your heart have these billions of dollars in the bank and know that there are people that are literally dying for lack of enough food to take care of themselves? How can that be right? Now, I'm not stupid enough to think that socialism is the answer to this. Some people think so, but socialism is not the answer. No form of human government is the answer, because you always have the moral problem with humans. Whatever system you have, the wicked are going to know how to utilize that system in such a way as to get at the top, and they'll just do the same thing all over again. There is no human government that you can devise that is going to change it, because the heart of man is evil. So, yeah, you know, when you look at this, it's very clear that the super wealthy could eradicate poverty. They could do that by sharing their massive hoarded wealth with the poor. There is another way, though, to do away with poverty. They could kill off billions of poor people when they're of no more use to them. That would be another way of doing away with poverty. And my question is, which method do you think they prefer? These are real questions that concern us today in the time that we live. And it's really no joke. Here's what they need to think about. The king is coming again. This time it's not going to be on a donkey. He's not coming again on a donkey. He's coming on a war horse with all of the armies of heaven with him. Revelation 19:11-12. I saw the heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it is called faithful and true. In righteousness he judges and makes war. Makes war. You know, sometimes people think there's a difference between the Yeshua in the Gospels and the Yeshua of the book of Revelation. But you know, when I think of Yeshua driving those money changers out of the temple, this is not hard for me to understand, that the day would come when he would come back to make war against those very people that basically are standing in the way of the kingdom. He's just not going to let them do that indefinitely. Isaiah 11 says this, with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with equity for the humble of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will kill the wicked. Now, these are not fun things to talk about. We don't want to see anybody get hurt, do we? But we also don't want to see wickedness rule the earth forever. This is not to the glory of God, for wickedness just to go on forever, for evil people to think they are God, essentially, and that everything belongs to them, for them to go on oppressing the world and stealing, essentially, from the poor. That has to come to a conclusion. And the only way it can come to a conclusion is if our King, Yeshua, comes and makes war with those people. Because they're not going to give it up. They're not going to give it up peacefully. And that's already been proven when he came on a donkey. Think of what this means. At last, the earth will have the powerful, but just and righteous government that the poor and the honest-hearted have always longed to have. It's always the wicked that ruin everything for us, isn't it? Why do you even need to lock your door in your car or your house? Can you imagine living in a world where we could just throw away all the keys? That's just one little thing. That's what the kingdom will be like for those who enjoy it here on the earth. No more oppression. People free from all of that. Free from poverty, sickness, and disease. Living in the world that our Creator intended. All we can say is, come quickly, Lord Yeshua.
You have been listening to Hebraic Insights in the Gospels. Some of the scripture verses referenced in today's program are Luke chapter 19, verse 28 through verse 48, Mark chapter 14, verse 3 through verse 10, John chapter 11, verse 1, and chapter 12, verse 11, Luke chapter 4, verse 18 through verse 19, Luke chapter 6, verse 20, Matthew chapter 21, verse 5, Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9, John chapter 2, verse 15, Revelation chapter 19, verse 11 through verse 12, and Isaiah chapter 11, verse 4. Further teachings and study materials on Messiah, Messiah's kingdom, the laws of Messiah's kingdom, otherwise known as the Torah and the rest of the scriptures, what will happen at Messiah's return, the elite and their role in Bible prophecy, the one world government of the anti-Messiah prophesied to happen in the last days, the role of the remnant of Israel as an alternate choice, a light to the world, and a sign of the coming of Messiah's kingdom in the last days, the great harvest from out of every nation that will happen after the remnant of Israel returns, more about how Yeshua came as the King of Israel, and how you can be prepared for his return in these last days, along with many other related topics, can be found at our membership site, Zion Tabernacle. Sign up is free. Just go to zion.net. That's TSIYON.NET. New programs on the Gospels will be airing every Sabbath on Zion Road Radio. Tune in next Shabbat to learn more from Hebraic Insights in the Gospels. Shabbat Shalom! The restoration of the remnant of Israel is one of the most undertaught, neglected, and unknown major events in Bible prophecy. A strange fact, since prophecies and references to this event can be found all throughout almost every major book of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. Now, Yahweh has raised up Zion Ministry to teach his remnant nation of Israel everything they need to know about this often neglected truth in his perfect timing. To learn who the remnant of Israel is, what the Zion mission is, and why we teach the things we do, go to our website at zion.org and click on Remnant Vision in the menu bar. That's TSIYON.ORG.